there's definitely a real chance that Wall Street tries to create a bunch of permissioned asset ledgers, and then you try and use Chainlink or Layer Zero or Wormhole or whatever to make them talk to each other and or to public chains. I think there's a real probability that that is the end state configuration. But I think over time, they'll just kind of realize like, hey, like there's all this money over here. Like I'll just go drop a contract down in the UI, and I am better off doing that than I am having any notion of bridging at all. We aren't yet at the point where like that is the expectation of consumers, but I do think in 3 to 5 years, probably, that will be the expectation of consumers.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Say, the blazing fast parallelized blockchain, which is unlocking Solana-like performance for the vast ocean of ETH devs out there. Now, you're going to be hearing all about Say and their new V2 upgrade, but if you take away one thing, the EVM is here to stay. There are some problems with it, which we're going to get into later in the episode, but Say, and especially their V2 upgrade, is helping solve that. So thank you very much, Say, for making this episode possible. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience in crypto, period, bar none. One thing I want to call out is the Uniswap extension. So say goodbye to these days of these annoying sort of pop-up wallet extensions. You lose your place trading, you have to open it back up. Uniswap now has a nice, sleek sidebar that persists no matter where you are on the web. It's much easier to use. If you click the link at the bottom of this episode, you can join the waiting list. And I'll see what I can do to get you moved up that waiting list. But definitely go click the link, check it out. If you're building anything in Web3, you likely need oracles and verifiable randomness. That's why Bellcurve is partnering up with Supra, which offers the fastest oracles and DVRF free for listeners of Bellcurve for 12 months. And you can get that at supra.com/blockworks. The link there is in the show notes, or stick around. We're going to be talking about them later in the program.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bellcurve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views, and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
In today's episode, Hart and I are going to be talking with Kyle Samani of Multicoin about network effects. Now, Hart and I have been touching indirectly on network effects actually for a large part of this season. We've been trying to get an understanding of what the market structure dynamics are going to be in between different L1s, and critically, where user lock-in is going to accrue. Now, we wanted to get Kyle on here because over the years, he's written an enormous amount about network effects, and I think has some of the more interesting first principle takes on network effects in the entire industry. And we ended up going down a little bit of a rabbit hole just in terms of how to think about L1s. Are they more equity-like or commodity-like? And it was sort of an interesting rabbit hole, but it was actually my favorite part of the entire episode. And before we get into it, I want to remind everyone that although our guest this week is a managing partner of a registered investment advisor, nothing in this podcast should be considered an offer of Multicoin's investment advisory services or otherwise be confused for investment, tax, legal, or financial advice. All right, we love a good disclaimer. Now let's get into it.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bellcurve. Today, I'm joined by my trusty co-host, Hart. And today, we're talking to Kyle Samani, Multicoin, about network effects. Kyle, welcome to the show.
What's up, Mike? What's up, Hart? Longtime listener, first-time caller.
Yeah,
I love it.
For the folks in the audience, we got a little telegram going. We chat about debrief on some of the episodes, so it's good to have you live here, Kyle.
It's a pleasure. Bellcurve has become one of my favorite podcasts, so excited to be on the show.
Yeah, we're pumped to have you. And you know, there's really no one better. One of the topics that Hart and I have mentioned a whole bunch this season, but haven't devoted an entire episode to, but it keeps coming up, is this idea of network effects. And of course, the entire theme of this season is how is the multi-chain endgame going to play out? We're seeing the creation of a whole bunch of different type of networks and starting to ask this question, like, where is the lock-in ultimately going to happen? And, you know, you've created a whole bunch of posts over the years, sort of your evolving view of network effects and how they work in blockchains. Maybe just starting out from a really high level, can you just give like a quick overview definition of what network effects are? And then just starting from a 10,000 foot view, you know, how do you sort of view this intersection of network effects and blockchains?
Sure. So I'll start with kind of the elementary definition. Traditional network effect, when you think of it as a telephone, if you have one telephone on the planet, it's useless because you have no one to call. The more people who have telephones, the more useful the network is because now you can call more people and more people can call you. This is known as Metcalfe's law. Is kind of traditionally the way this is talked about. Metcalf's Law, I think, was introduced in the late 70s or early 80s, if I'm not mistaken, by a guy named Bob Metcalf, who I think invented Ethernet, if I'm not mistaken. Metcalf's Law says the value of the network is equal to the square of the number of the nodes. And I think that is very, very, very wrong. If you had a network where the value of the network was proportional to the square, and that held true from N of 1 through N of 8 billion, or like even through N of 1 billion, that like, then you wouldn't ever have a competitive service in any of these markets. Like, that would mean that iOS kills Android or Android kills iOS. It just would imply the strength of the network would be so strong in one that it wouldn't allow the existence of another. In practice, almost all network effects look like an S-curve, where like there's clearly some point of exponential value. And then like, just think about like you on Facebook, like, does it matter to you that the next 20 million people join Facebook in Australia, assuming you're an American? Like, not really. No, it doesn't. And so there is a point of tapering, right, on that curve. Different networks, and depending on how people use the applications and such, will have different shapes of those S-curves. But at the end of the day, they will always look like some sort of S-curve. So I think that's one of the generally things that's misunderstood about network effects. People just talk about Metcalf's Law and they say N squared. And I'm like, nah, man, it's for sure not N squared. I guess start there. We can, I'm sure, go in a lot more directions.
Yeah. That makes a ton of sense. Very intuitive to me as well. I'd love to start maybe getting a little bit more specific and talking about some of the different types of network effects that exist. And maybe we can start to, so if there's maybe some sort of tapering off, most network effects aren't this sort of exponential N squared type thing, but more of an S curve. I think what we can start to tease out is like, what does that mean for the ultimate end state of like, how many different sorts of blockchains do we need for one? But maybe when you, Kyle, start to think about network effects as they pertain to blockchains. Like, what are some of the weird sort of idiosyncrasies that maybe the audience should be aware of? And like, one thing that I know that you've talked about, at least on the smart contract platform level, is this idea of anti-network effects. So not only is it not exponential, but these networks can actually get less and less useful the more users that they get, which is sort of a counterintuitive idea. So you break down this idea of anti-network effects and how you think about the network effects that pertain to smart contract platforms more generally.
Yeah, so blockchains introduce a new phenomenon that we call anti-network effects. Talk about this in my presentation from the Multicoin Summit in September of 2023. And the colloquial term for this is gas fees. And everyone knows that, like, if you're on Ethereum and a lot of people use the network, gas fees go up. Obviously, gas fees are the definition of an anti-network effect and has been the source of consternation for, you know, kind of the whole industry, really, for like 5 or 6 years at this point. And there's still like not super clear definitive answers, and hence the whole point of this season of Bell Curve is trying to get some clarity on that stuff. So the shape of the, as you increase number of users on, if the x-axis, the y-axis for most blockchains is more of a parabola, just right, like a full parabola kind of a thing, which is obviously pretty strange. People have been trying to figure out how to solve that problem with more chains, which theoretically each of which may be subject to its own parabola, but assuming you have enough chains and they can talk to each other, that might be one way to solve it. Another way to solve it might be to push out the parabola far enough that you don't ever get to it. So there are different ways to get there. But yeah, I mean, the core problem is gas fees, which I think anyone who's listening to this is familiar with at this point.
Kyle, on that, right? So we're basically saying there's a fixed resource, which is like how much I'll use block space, how much block space there is on a blockchain. And as you hit some sort of critical point of utilization, it just gets like exponentially more expensive.
Yeah, the 0x team did a really good presentation on this. The data is a few years old, but I'm pretty sure would hold today if you were to update the analysis, which basically shows that as you get to somewhere between 80 and 90% of utilization, the fees just go vertical. And like for every marginal bit of demand you increase, like the fees double. Like it's crazy, which is intuitive.
Yeah, it is intuitive and it makes sense. And like another way I guess I'd push on it is it is a scalability thing. It's like if we can't meet demand, then like at some point that marginal, that last like 10% of available space just ends up getting crazy expensive. But like, wouldn't that also apply to like in the internet, just network usage, like literally bandwidth for connecting the internet? But we just haven't hit that scalability kind of threshold. Like, doesn't the same concept apply?
No. I really hate when people talk compare crypto to the internet. In multiple ways, actually. In terms of like TAM and market size and usefulness, all that shit. But also in terms of like technical stack and modularity, it's also total nonsense. And the fundamental reason is the internet is stateless and crypto is by definition stateful. The whole point of crypto is that like I have a balance and today and the balance will be there tomorrow, right? And with the internet, when I send a packet from me to a server, like, okay, if it's TCP/IP, like it'll send an acknowledgement back to me. But like that transaction is over. And there's no statefulness. You could argue that like the routing tables and the routers is a form of statefulness in the internet, which is technically true, but like is not a constraint in any way in the system. And like that's just statically coded, right? Like, hey, I'm this router. Where's the other router? I got to go send it over there. And like that fundamental discrepancy breaks all, or I don't know, discrepancy, excuse me, fundamental like first order difference in what you're doing with the system changes everything about how to reason about trade-offs you should make, usability, what you should optimize for, etc., because of the statefulness of the system.
Okay, so just to actually refine that a bit more, because like, okay, if I did have, and again, I actually do agree that comparisons of blockchains to the internet kind of suck, but what I'm trying to compare is the technological concept of like you have a fixed resource and at some point like you hit limits of what that resource can do. So if I have a network pipe between two places and I just start bumping up against bandwidth constraints, packets are going to get dropped or something like that. But I think what you're saying is actually the stateful property of blockchains makes a huge difference here, because I literally like can't do the next useful thing in a blockchain if I'm not recording state correctly. Whereas I guess in the network example, if a packet gets dropped, maybe someone's kind of pissed, but it's like less bad.
That's not quite how I would think about it. I mean, like if there's a pipe between your server and I'm a user and like you're trying to send more packets than can fit in the pipe, then what happens is you wait for the rest of the packets to come through. There's no other solution. And so that means either the UX degrades and the user has to wait for the system to load or to buffer or whatever, or the application doesn't exist. And my favorite example of that would be Netflix. Reed Hastings is very famous, where like in the seed deck for Netflix, he's like, mail is stupid. We're going to go to streaming. But the bandwidth's not there yet. And he drew a chart of Nielsen's law showing bandwidth. And he's like, here's like 6 years before they launch streaming. He's like, here's when we're going to launch streaming. But we're going to do mail until then. So there wasn't enough of bandwidth in the pipe, so you couldn't do streaming. And so the application didn't exist, right, until the bandwidth was there. But that's an inherently kind of a bilateral transaction. In blockchains, you have a globally stateful system. And so it's just you're moving from a bilateral stateless transaction to a multilateral stateful transaction.
So, Kyle, aren't there some examples, though, of like, right, your name used to be Composability Kyle, right? Aren't there some arguments that there are network effects to have all these different applications on the same and with like that can touch the same pieces of state, right? Like you saw this with Ethereum in the early days. You see it maybe a little bit on Solana now. I think that's broken a tiny bit with, well, actually, it's kind of a pain point in Ethereum right now because of the lack of interop between L2s. So, like, aren't there some advantages to all being on the same protocol and network?
Oh, for sure, right? I mean, again, so let's like specifically state what blockchains are useful for so that we can reason about them. Blockchains are asset ledgers. They keep track of who owns what. And then DeFi is really what DeFi is doing is encoding mathematical relationships basically between the prices of various assets. So the simple example would be Uniswap, right? You got XY equals K, and you're now encoding that relationship based on the state that is in the contracts. With you look at a borrow lend protocol, you're encoding a relationship between debt from borrowers against collateral that's deposited, and you're making sure that like one's not higher than the other, or rather one is always higher than the other. And so like that is what DeFi is encoding those mathematical relationships. And so like in theory, it would be great if we can just have a bunch of asset ledgers and like you could just say, well, you know, debit one from here and credit one over there. Obviously it's very simple in theory, and as you all both well know, very difficult in practice. And so like that's like the fundamental source of tension. Flash loans are a very cool concept, intellectually, not worth optimizing for in overall system design. And like, look, if we got to a world in which we believed that you could have six different forms of collateral locked in six different contracts, borrow lend systems, all of which act as a single collateral pool on which you can draw debt on another chain, and like, and the system designers believe that like they can collapse, you know, wind positions down if necessary, and all the lenders also are convinced of the fact that you can wind positions down, then like, then there would be no network effects around a single chain. And so like the better bridging gets, loosely speaking, the less a given chain matters. So far, it doesn't seem like, for a bunch of technical reasons, that like bridging is going to get anywhere close to that point. And so because of that, now you have to think about financial risk. The longer these things take to move around, obviously that's a huge source of volatility and risk of liquidation. If you don't have guarantees that like if liveness failures and like part of the chain goes down, you're not finalizing blocks, that impacts your ability to do these things. And so now you just have all of these like cascading complications on, you know, relaying states of chains to one another. And again, in theory, these are tractable problems. Like you can describe theoretical ways in which it all works that does not violate the laws of physics. But then getting everyone to agree on the right set of standards to do those things is like very, very hard. As I like to joke sometimes, every problem in all of technology is a standards problem. In like the sense of like, if everyone agrees to use this thing, then all the problems go away. But like, of course, no one ever gets everyone to agree to use the same standard. So I've been ranting for a while. I'll pause now.
Well, no, I mean, Kyle, I think Mike has a bunch in there, and he's got a really nice agenda that I want to make sure we work through. But I do want to push on a couple of things. So first of all, on the bridging stuff, sidebar, I'd love to talk to you about how we solve bridging, but that's a different conversation. on the what blockchains are useful for, because I did just in prep for this rewatch your multi-chain or multi-coin summit. And you make a strong push that blockchains are useful for trading and payments, which I actually agree that they are very much useful for trading and payments. And I very much agree with your analogies around like what DeFi is encoding rules for how you transfer or transform assets. But it's actually, I think it is a pretty controversial view to say that blockchains are useful for trading and payments and like less for other things. Because I do think there's a lot of people out there that want to use blockchains for decentralized social media or building their game or whatever else there is. And in those use cases, I feel like the argument for those applications owning their own ledger could actually be pretty compelling, where they want to own their own ledger, even for like political or monetary or sort of just control reasons. Even if it makes the UX mildly worse for the user. And I'm kind of just curious what your thoughts are on that.
So like the market seems to ascribe a premium to things that are asset ledgers, whether those are L1s or L2s, and I assume fairly soon L3s and L4s. But I can't explain from first principles why that should be true. So there's a weird perverse incentive that skews how developers think just because like they're following the money. From first principles, I cannot articulate why you are better off being on your own asset ledger. The best arguments I have heard are so that you can capture MEV to yourself, which is a pretty reasonable thing to believe, and one I did believe for some period of time. But I have come to realize that, like, you can generally capture the MEV back to yourself just by controlling the contracts. And by, if you control the front end and you control the contracts, you don't need to control consensus to capture MEV. So, like, the very simple example here would be if you're like Aave for liquidations. Well, like, the contracts dictate, like, okay, you submitted a liquidation request, like, just take part of the liquidation fee and send it to the Aave DAO, right? And you can enforce that contractually. If you look at, if you've got to step through all of the various forms of MEV other than SEX DEX arbitrage and DEX DEX arbitrage, obviously, I think you can construct ways where you take the fees, the MEV back to the front end, back to the contract. And then you look at things like even like NFT mints. I mean, again, there's very easy ways to get MEV back to the contracts. You can run any form of auction system you want. Auctions don't need to be run on chain. Like, you can host them on a server and, like, you can get the MEV for yourself that way. So I'm generally skeptical of the MEV argument to get revenue back to yourself. I think the notion of, like, dealing with consensus is, and that is, like, not worth doing. And then also you're creating complexity because now the user has bridger assets and, like, do they know where their wallets are? It's like all these other weird second and third order effects that I would prefer to avoid for users. So that's part of it. The other part is like control and performance stuff. Control is control, and like some people want to have control over their own stack because that's what they want. And like you can't ever stop people from wanting what they want. So if they want it, go for it. Have fun. It makes the most sense in games, and specifically creating a sidechain or an L2 makes the most sense in games because the front ends to interact with that state are inherently non-global, or in fact, rather the opposite, they're hyper-localized typically to a canonical front end. People are talking about like mod front ends and crypto gaming, and we'll see if any of that stuff goes anywhere. But for now, let's just assume a game has a single canonical front end. In that configuration, like then you control the front end, you can just, and like all of the state of the game is only relevant to users through your front end because you control the canonical front end. So you effectively are guaranteeing localization of the economy, so to speak. So that's fine and well, if you want to be on your own sidechain or L2 for that reason, I think that's okay. To me, the most interesting thing about blockchains is global financial markets. And that's the beauty of why DeFi Summer was so exciting, was it was for the first time in human history, a permissionless global financial market. And you had people on Twitter at all hours of the day, and Chef Nami showed up and like forked Uni, and like people forked all the contracts and had food coins and whatever, right? And that's why Solana meme coins are fun right now, is for the same reason. People make funny memes in Chinese and in Korean and in English and in Germany, and like it goes viral, and you have a global market. And so that, yeah. I haven't seen anyone be able to, well, it has not defined the laws of physics to create an L2 for your app that is a global market, but we have yet to see a single instance in which you can, you know, create small or application specific L2s and have global financial markets where all of the requisite infrastructure around liquidity and indexing and wallets and users and just all that shit just works. Again, it is possible. It just has never been done before. And it's fundamentally, it's a standards problem. The reason it worked on Ethereum in 2020 and the reason it works on Solana today is because there was one standard. It was the ETH L1 standard. And then there's a bunch of secondary things on top of that with liquidity providers. And the same is true now with Solana.
There's another place where it sort of works, interestingly, I'm putting, because the UX is still very challenged, but Cosmos also figured this out with IBC. There's a really interesting path dependency between, like, basically Cosmos has a bunch of app chains. Ethereum now has a bunch of app chains and gen purpose L2s. Interop is quite good in Cosmos. It's not very good in Ethereum. And I actually think it's this like squishy social thing where actually the vision for Cosmos to begin with was this interoperable set of different app chains. And so they built these basically like, I don't know what you'd call IBC. You could call it a public good. It's just like a set of pipes that everyone from day one was like, I'm buying into this. And now the intractable problem, to your point, Kyle, is just like, and Hart and I ended last episode talking about this, is just there isn't a real incentive for big L2s to become interoperable, right? Actually, the incentive is sort of the opposite, right? It's to not be interoperable. It's to become interoperable within my little fiefdom, right? But not...
And there's a few other like angles at work here. So I thought, like, Kyle, I think your answer was like very honest, right? Like, so the market today does seem to ascribe a premium to owning your own asset ledger on your own chain for whatever reason. And that's creating incentives. And, you know, you and I have been talking for years about how cool global permissionless finance is. And I do generally agree, at least at a first principle level, having everything on the same asset ledger makes that easier. And that's kind of cool and something we should be excited about, period. But like there are other reasons why people want their own asset ledger that are, again, kind of perverse. If you think of the cleanest example I would have is poker chain. I want like, or my casino chain, where people are going to play my blackjack and poker on my chain. I actually want it like a casino where money comes into my ledger and then never really leaves. It's in my best interest to actually be like a vacuum that sucks assets onto my chain. The same is also true with any kind of like perpetual exchange or margin trading account, where I actually want to design my margin trading application to get money into my margin account and it never leaves. And so this is just where I think it's a really interesting conversation where kind of like, paternalistically, it would be better if everything was on one ledger, but there's lots of incentives for why teams would want to actually suck your assets onto their own place and make it hard for them to come off.
I agree with that. There's incentives to do that. And then it's like, oh, you deposited dollars, I'll take the yield. And like, there's all kinds of other funny games you can play. For those reasons, I think there will be L2s, right, for at least a while. But I also think that like over time, as we have more and more stuff scaling on a single global market, at some point it'll just be like only the weird things on the side that are explicitly exploiting the perverse incentives will be doing that, and that mainstream folks just won't. Or if you wanted to frame it in like broader historical terms, right, like the arc of history bends towards justice. And like, yeah, you'll never have a perfectly just world. But like, in general, we will move in that direction. I think that's a reasonable assumption.
Hey, everyone. Wanted to give a big shout out to today's title sponsor, Say. Now, I want to talk to you guys a little bit about why I think Say is cool from a design standpoint, a big problem that it solves for ETH devs out there, and then some cool stuff that Say has coming up. The reason I like Say from an architecture perspective is, again, it's a very fast blockchain, parallelization, all of that stuff. But Say has essentially been custom building block space, which is for consumer apps and DEXs. Now, they have some very cool features which enable that. So twin turbo consensus, optimistic parallelization, Say DB, all of this stuff allows you to reduce the time to finality, make for very, very fast transactions. So if you're building a consumer app or a DEX, this is basically the blockchain for you. If you've been building in the EVM, you love the EVM, but there are some restrictions about it that don't support your app. So maybe you can't do fast enough transactions or it's not parallelized, whatever it is, you can now take all of that stuff that you built. You don't have to start from scratch and you can build it on Say. Now, recently they've launched V2, but also public DevNet. So the way that you can follow that and keep up to date is go and follow Say Network on Twitter. All right. Thanks, guys. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Uniswap, delivering the best on-chain trading experience, period, bar none, in all of crypto. Here's how I would divide the protocol today. There's a web part, a mobile part, and an extension part. You can say goodbye to the pop-up wallet extension, which is just not great from a UX perspective. Now what they've delivered is this nice, clean sidebar where you can just very easily track swaps, sign transactions, send or receive crypto anywhere. Just a huge UX improvement. On the web part of it, huge improvements here. You can buy and sell 700 plus tokens at your price, on your terms, and they've got limit orders, which are powered by Uniswap X, and there's gasless. They've also got real-time charts, transaction logs, pool data, project information, all this cool stuff that just really improves your UX trading on the web. And again, all of this is powered by the smartest protocol in terms of Uniswap or Uniswap X. Click the link at the bottom. Uniswap extension is in alpha right now, and we'll see what we can do about getting you moved up that list. Thank you very much, Uniswap. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Supra, delivering the freshest Oracle price feeds across 50 plus blockchains. When it comes to crypto, speed and security are both critical. And luckily for y'all, Super has you covered on both of those things. Be that for liquidation triggers, critical price levels, whatever it is, Super's got your back. The other great thing about Super, they love listeners of Bell Curve. So they're going to hook you guys up with 12 months of free Oracle services and verifiable randomness. They call it DVRF, decentralized verifiable randomness. So 12 months free. You just got to go to super.com/blockworks. Two more cool things about Supra. They're really secure, easy to integrate. They run on 12 times lower gas speeds than other oracles out there. So you're going to save on that as well. And if you're listening and you know builders that need services like Supra, you can actually refer them and get $1,500 in referral. So to get all these goodies, you just got to go to supra.com/blockworks. And again, the link there is in the bottom of the show notes. Click that so I know that I sent you. Cheers, guys. Moving into this whole idea of like integrated versus more modular spread out approaches, one of the things that Hart and I have been trying to reason about this season is this combination of, as you start to unbundle what has traditionally been bundled into one blockchain, like what are the sticky parts of that? Like, one, where are network effects like in those layers as they're now getting unbundled? But two, where does like user lock in and value accrual end up happening? So like one way to reason about a blockchain before everything was spread out was that you kind of have this network of computers, these computers all do a certain thing, and then there's a token which is used as a ledger for that computer. And the more things that this set of computers can do, and the more applications that are built on top of this compute, like the set of computers, theoretically, the more valuable this like unit of account sort of thing is. Now, I think there are some interesting data points which might dispute that like pretty simple view of the world. And now we've had, in many cases, like even with Ethereum's roll-up centric roadmap, you have like a protocol that has an asset, which is ETH, but then you're kind of exporting wrapped versions of that asset up to these new layer twos, right, that are next to it. Another really interesting data point here would be Bitcoin, which flies in the face of this very simple worldview, which is that protocol hasn't really improved in many years. Like arguably there hasn't been a major upgrade since like Taproot. I'm not even sure how, well, actually with Ordinals, I guess that's going to indirectly end up being really influential, but like really since like the block size wars in Taproot, not much has happened in Bitcoin land, but Bitcoin has expanded its market cap of its token by, you know, a full order of magnitude or whatever. So it kind of begs the question here. I think you can point to a couple of areas where there are network effects and they're actually a little bit divorced from this idea of just like more useful apps that are being built on these platforms. Like one would be Bitcoin. And that implies to me that there's a very different set of network effects that takes hold of the token as opposed to the underlying protocol where there are anti-network effects that you were describing. I think another area of the stack would actually that's pretty sticky is the execution layer, like the EVM. And the SVM certainly have some amount of network effects that accrue to it, although it's TBD, like how or if that filters back up into the token price. So I guess like to put to you here, like what is your take on how Bitcoin was able to grow its network effect and the token and sort of the value of the token while the technology underneath didn't improve? And do you see this world where the tokens versus the actual protocols are starting to sort of separate and compete on different vectors?
Lots there to unpack.
There's like seven questions everything. There in one. I know.
I'll do my best here. I'll start with Bitcoin because it's the funny one. Agree. Bitcoin is the special snowflake. Bitcoin. The market action and the commentary around Bitcoin, as you alluded to, would make it the special snowflake. I believe it's just the ugly child and is actually worthless. But I understand why people think it's this.
Wow, that's a spicy take.
Flaming hot take, Kyle.
Wow, Kyle.
This isn't new. I've been saying Bitcoin is not worth anything for a long time. And I will stand by that and take it to the grave. I think innovate or die like is like the core of the world. And everyone else would be like, the point of Bitcoin is it doesn't innovate and it's special. And like, Kyle, you don't get it. And we can go back and forth on that. But I understand why Bitcoin's story is not one of usage or usability. So the notion that like it's technology matters is by definition irrelevant because of the story that you're told. Bitcoin is an RNG that has historically trended upwards. The BTC USD price is an RNG that has historically trended upwards. I generally think it will go upwards probably for another year or two or three. I don't think it will be an RNG with an upward trend. I think it will become just an RNG within 5 or 6 years. Because at some point the market cap can't just like keep outpacing all other assets. Like it will just become too big. And so it will turn into an RNG. And then eventually it'll get flipped by Solana or something else. but that's a separate story. But yeah, Bitcoin is special because it's special. Like it's circular, right? So you have to just accept that for what it is. Ethereum, I guess the question is like, how do you explain Ethereum price performance, even though ETH is like being as an asset is being disintermediated? Is that the question at hand, Mike?
Yeah, it's well. Can I actually push on that whole like ugly child? I'm not like defending Bitcoin one way or the other, but like I think you could actually attach a more rational explanation to it, which is that like I don't know. This has been as long as I've been in crypto. There's been sort of these like two camps of people, like oversimplifying here, but there's like the monetarists and the technologists. And the monetarists say like the way that these assets are competing are the way that money competes, like liquidity, Lindy, all of this stuff, right? And then there's this other group, which Kyle, maybe it sounds like you fall a little bit more into, which is like, guys, like that feels really pie in the sky. Like ultimately, innovate or die, the tech has to get better, the shit has to actually do stuff. And the doing of the stuff and the creation of like real revenue and demand, like that's what's ultimately going to drive what's going to drive value. And like empirically, maybe this would be a data point that flies in the face. Like this could be sort of point number one in the camp of the monetarists, where like really maybe this stuff, like once you achieve some sort of critical mass, it just kind of takes off. And like, isn't it kind of funny to you guys that like, not that anyone on this channel is like a TA sort of trader, but like you can look at the price appreciation of like ETH and it looked really similar to like what Bitcoin did the last cycle. And like Solana looked very much like that, you know, the price fractal for Solana last cycle looked very much like Ethereum in the ICO days. Like, doesn't it just feel funny to you that it moves in these like very sort of consistent patterns? And to me, these are all data points that suggest that like, maybe it's not all about the technology and the innovation and these networks actually doing stuff. Like maybe it is like, maybe all these networks are like way more commoditized than we all give it credit for. And they're all just going to trade on kind of like Lindy, liquidity, something like that. I know that sounds so pie in the sky and that doesn't sound good on a podcast, but like, aren't those like data points that support the more monetarist point of view as opposed to the technologist point of view?
Can it all be true, Mike? Like, I don't know. I'm curious Kyle's view on this, but like it can, both can be true, right? So they trade on this like weird TA technical hype cycle thing. But I do think, like, I do agree with Kyle that innovate or die should be the motto of anyone building technology, and the technologies that are not innovating should die, right? Mm. Now, I also will say that Bitcoin might actually truly be a special case of like digital gold and it's just doing something else. And like, I actually think that's a very reasonable view. I'm pretty bearish on like Bitcoin L2s, for example. That seems like just like trying to innovate with your hands tied and your feet tied, like just seems very hard to do. I don't know, Kyle, your thoughts?
Agreed exactly on Bitcoin L2s. Look, will you create a casino that has a Bitcoin that's orange on the front? Like, yeah, great. Will you build anything that is going to change global finance or power global DePIN or gaming? I think no chance. I don't think anyone who's building a Bitcoin L2, like that's even entered their mind that like that's what they might be building one day. Doesn't mean it's impossible to get there. I just think like the because of A, the technical constraints of the system, and B, the kinds of people who have been attracted to build there today in 2024, you're basically just getting people who want to build casinos. And the people who like want to change the world wouldn't deal with Bitcoin because it can't change the world. Like it's just, there's just too many constraints there. And if you wanted to change the world, you wouldn't impose those constraints on yourself. Mike, come back to your question of like, how do you explain the price cycles and the movements? The monetarist thing is real. And obviously Bitcoin is very monetarist and Ethereum is monetarist-ish. Depending on who you ask, it's more or less of that. And Solana is like almost like pure techist, kind of through that lens, where Anatoly is like, yo man, ultrasound money is stupid. Solana's not money. It's like, he's like, we're here to build NASDAQ on chain. So I think that spectrum of views is clearly there. I think the reason that like the valuation of ETH is what it is mostly because like the entire outside and also the explanation for why crypto generally moves in cycles and clearly there are correlations is because the asset class relative to all other asset classes has been extremely small. And so if dollars leave other asset classes to flow into crypto, then kind of sort of like all of the top things have to go up together. Just mathematically, that must be true. So that explains a lot of the correlation effect. That will become less true over time as crypto gets bigger. And we're starting to see that now. And then the other part of it is just like crypto is just weird because like in some places it's illegal or like borderline illegal, or like in the US it's like legal, but like Gensler is like, nah, man, crypto bad. And, you know, and like you go ask people who work in finance full time and they're like, I don't know what crypto is. Like my compliance team tells me I can own it, but I shouldn't own it. So I don't pay attention. So it's just like, it's just treated as the, like the ugly stepchild of financial markets. And so for that reason, the knowledge people have is weird. People learn about Bitcoin first, inevitably, and then they try and apply that frame to Ethereum and Solana, and Ethereum and Solana are like first order different things, but they're called cryptocurrencies. And like you go to CoinMarketCap and like it's Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Solana. So people think they're the same. They're called currencies. And so people are like, oh, it's, you buy coffee with it, but then like it doesn't work for coffee. And so there's just so much like background and informational context that is somewhere between outright wrong or like unhelpful that people have when they start trying to learn about them. And then like, then you get to the questions of valuation and like you're already so misinformed and unconfused that like, I think all of that combined can get you to the point where Ethereum is trading at 8x Solana. And like Solana at this point, I think has a higher probability of having a better scaling roadmap. Ethereum may get there, but like, I don't know how you say Ethereum has a higher probability today. And Solana is doing the same volumes as Ethereum on chain. And these are trading systems. Like that's what they're for. Like we, like, you know, like we have the data. And so like, that's the only way I can explain it is just like, there's enough inertia and confusion that this one, I think if this was equities and you had like equivalent, like NASDAQ versus CFTC or excuse me, NASDAQ versus CME kind of a thing, I don't think the discrepancy in valuations or narratives would be this large.
I got like, I don't know. I guess I have to, it's too dangerous for me to just reason out loud about something that I'm trying to articulate in my head here. But I do think it's like, it's worth pointing out. I guess what I was trying to get at before is these things aren't equities, right? Like it's not like these things don't generate cash flow, which accrue to some sort of balance sheet that these protocols can then spend and like compound their advantage. Like it's different. And maybe the clearest way that I could articulate that is like if Solana was a company, it would be actually taking some kind of rent, which would then go into a balance sheet. They would spend, hire more employees and do that. Whereas I view the point of both Ethereum, Solana, and Bitcoin is to get its asset out into the hands of as many people as possible. Like the reason why Solana might go up if more people trade on Solana isn't because it generates cash flow for Solana that can then be reinvested. It's because if you're trading on Solana, then the dominant pair where liquidity is probably Solana WIF, or Sol WIF or Sol Doge or whatever. And then more people have to go out and hold Solana. And then the more distributed the currency is, the bigger the network effect that it ultimately has, the more liquid it is, et cetera. And I don't know. That's how I think you can explain some of these differences in between, like why sometimes technology doesn't end up driving the same type of gains. Like tech and innovation advances don't end up driving the same type of gains that you otherwise might expect to see. But I know, Hart, you got one question here for Kyle about the finance use case. I wanna ask about data network effects next, which I know Kyle, you're into. So,
I wanted to push back on that, Mike.
Oh, really? Well, push back, Kyle.
I want to hear that.
So I agree, which is if you hold ETH or you hold SOL, you can earn yield. And that yield comes from two places. One is MEV, which I think is the more important source of yield. And the other is people paying the gas fees and then the inflation. And so you end up, you know, owning a higher percentage of the network over time, which means you get to get more of the MEV, right? Which is real cash flow yielding. So so you can, just through that lens alone, you can use a DCF-like construct to produce evaluation methodology. Where it is not like an equity is like they're right. There's no balance sheet. There's no, it's not Microsoft and you just cut a fee of Windows or Office and you just get the fee, the money magically. So I agree in that sense, but like you can value these assets through that lens. And that is the primary way we think about valuation. It's also why I'm more bullish L2s than Ethereum is for that reason, but that's a whole separate dialogue.
Kyle, I was going to add to that too. Like Mike, as a thought experiment, you know, you're saying you want to get the asset in the hands of more users, right? So it's like, how many transactions are there? But as a thought experiment, like we don't have any identity. So it literally could just be two guys spinning up hundreds of thousands or millions of wallets trading with themselves, right? In concept here. And that's not real. But I do think that network usage is what actually matters here. And generally speaking, network usage is going to be correlated with more users, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be correlated with a fewer number of users using the network more. And I that's where I kind of do look at that as being like a cash flow like argument, like Kyle's saying. But, you know.
Well, I mean, the more trading is happening on chain, the more MEV there will be. That is a guarantee. And so the more assets there are, the higher the market cap of those assets, and the more people trade those assets, that guaranteed will produce MEV.
Yeah, I empathize with that view a lot. I guess we're just going to have to ultimately end up seeing how this plays out. Like again, maybe Bitcoin is like this special, lots of reasons to assume that Bitcoin might be unique. Immaculate conception, right? Like all of this stuff that is really hard to replicate, but maybe it's not. I used to think about like Bitcoin's on its own separate private island over here, and then there's every other blockchain. But like, honestly, the more that I think about it, I don't think it's actually that separate. And actually, like, you see these design convergences, like, okay, maybe Bitcoin L2s like don't end up working. Okay, maybe they do. And like, there are all these reasons, like right now people are talking about Solana L2s for sort of different, but sort of similar reasons why people talk about ETH L2s. It's not about cost savings. It's about sovereignty and control over your block space. There are all these different things that are sort of like suggesting to me that at the end of the day, like really what separates all these different chains is just the specs for your L1 validator. And everyone chose different trade-offs, but now, you know, people have gotten to such a point where like, well, actually I've kind of like solved this, you know, I've maximized the positive trade-off here. Now I'm going to try to solve the negative. And all these blockchains are starting to look more similar. And honestly, for ETH, I don't think ETH is underperforming relative to Sol right now. I'm not a trader. I don't know. Ignore any of this. You know, this is not financial advice. But like, probably the next thing that is needed to make ETH go up has nothing to do with usage or DCFing, future MEV rewards. It has to do with an Ethereum ETF. And the reason ETH is going to get an ETF is because it's been around long enough. There's a reference rate, there's a futures market, and it's liquid enough that you can put an ETF wrapper around it. So I don't know. I don't know what I'm really driving towards here, but I'm probably more in the camp now that there's people aren't valuing these things based on some sort of rational DCF, and these things are more commodity-like than they are equity-like, although there are obviously elements of both, I would say.
I agree that they're not being priced as if there's people running DCFs. Strongly agree with that. Even though folks like myself have tried to put that out there, but has not been well received yet, but it'll take time. I agree that they trade more like commodities than like equities. I also agree with that. Again, that, I think that will change over time, but for now is true. But yeah, I mean, like if all you're saying is the reason the price is going to go up is like your grandma's going to buy it in her IRA, then like, it's a trade. It's not an investment. I mean, that's kind of implicitly like what you're saying.
I do think all L1s are trades. Actually, I have this on record. I wrote this in a newsletter like 2 years ago. Like, I think I'll show you guys this chart. We're really going down a road that I didn't plan for this podcast, but like my whole view of crypto got changed by these two charts, which look at, if you look at the, like on a 200 or 300 year basis, like the returns of commodities, gold, yield-bearing cash, equities. It's like equities up here, everything else. And then if you look at the way that gold performed around these like crazy monetary things, you can see it like kind of spikes like this and then goes back down. And my the conclusion that I came to is the reason why equities perform so well is you can compound returns. What you can't do in any of these crypto economic systems is compound returns. It just doesn't work. They're anti-network effects that you just, because you can't, there's no organizing body which reinvests the profits. Even in your example where you're DCFing based on the MEV, all of that is basically just like, instead of in the company analogy, that would be like, I'm just going to use a dividend to pass all my returns back. There's no central organization which like takes the MEV and then invests that into new resources for the network. So it's like a constant dividend, I think.
I push back. So I understand what you're saying, but I think that's not capturing the reality of how these systems work. Mm. There is real compounding, coming back to network effects, which is the more state that is in the system, both literally like how many accounts have how many token balances, and also how many exchanges have on-ramps, how many third-party providers integrate with it, indexing providers, all this other forms of things that hook into the asset ledger. That is a source of network effect. And then where the actual compounding comes from is, hey, I'm a developer. I see that there's a million people who have USDC on chain or whatever. I want to tap into those people. So I know that they're, so I'm going to go build my own app. And like the difference between Microsoft in the 90s and this is like, yeah, Microsoft just charged you $25 per computer or $50 per computer. And they got to accrue it to the, and so they could reinvest in Windows, right? And make Windows better. Sure. But here, like the state is growing. The more state that grows, the more types of apps you can build, the more that you know, as you try to get new users for your app, they will have state and they can do stuff. And so that is an actual structural source of compounding. And then as those apps do stuff and people do stuff, that will produce MEV, which will then go back to the stakers of the L1. So the mechanics, Kyle, by which the value flows is different than what you would have had with Microsoft, but it is there and you can see it happening.
Yeah, Kyle, I actually like generally agree with that. I think, Mike, one other way to frame this is, you know, my bear case for crypto is we reinvent finance, and like we're the rails for finance in the future. That's my bear case. And the bull case is we do a bunch of other cool stuff that we haven't yet invented on top of that. And but if you believe that we're going to reinvent finance and crypto will be the rails for finance, that doesn't feel like a commodity like investment. That feels like an equity like investment. Like you're making a bet that this is a big deal technology that powers our world.
Totally. But who gets to capture that value? Is it the apps that are built on the substrate, or is it the substrate itself? And like, to me, like it's both. Yeah, it's definitely both. But like even Kyle, like I hear you, but I'm also just, you know, what you're describing a little bit sounds like this commodity type network effect where, okay, there's more state, and the more state there is, the more useful the commodity ultimately is. Here's a really good example of a commodity where you could make a really similar analogy. Oil. So oil actually used to be, it was so useless that when Standard Oil was getting created, they dumped it off in the Cuyahoga River because they couldn't come up with anything useful for it. And then eventually cars got invented. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, we could use this like effluent for, you know, driving machines. And then like the more different types of machines that got built around it, it creates like a network effect. And, you know, more machines are built that use oil, all that
gas stations and all
gas stations, all that other stuff, right? That's kind of what you're describing. But at the end of the day, oil is still a commodity. And I think that these things are all commodities, basically. And I think empirically, yeah.
But you can't take oil and get yield from more cars driving around. Like
that's a good point. That's a good point.
You can do that here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike, we can make another fun analogy to blockchains to the internet here, right? Which Kyle loves, where, you know, you're basically arguing that, you know, block space is like the TCP/IP pipes that connect the internet. Yeah. Right, it's a commodity, and the value accrual is on things built on top of that. And again, I'm not convinced of that. I actually think that the state of blockchains is valuable, not just for MEV, but for lots of other reasons, some of which I don't think are figured out yet. But that's a very interesting debate. I do think it's a kind of good segue back into the network effects bit. And a question I wanted to have for Kyle, which is, you know, if we focus on this finance use case for crypto, which is my bear case, crypto reinvents finance.
Wait, why is that your bear case, Hart? Just because you think crypto should be doing more than that? Or why is that the bear case?
Yeah, that's why. It's like maybe it's super optimistic, but like I think it's obvious to me that crypto makes for better financial rails than TradFi. Like it just does. And I honestly think, yeah, Kyle's thumbs up. It's like that is a mind-blowingly obvious statement to anyone that looks at how broken TradFi is. And so you're just like, this is obviously the better way for us to kind of like asset ledgers, like control, make payments and do trading. This seems straight up better. And so the bear case is that crypto just reinvents all of the financial rails. And then the bull case is we do a bunch of other stuff that we haven't yet invented on top of that. So that's my super optimistic. It sounds optimistic, but I actually think it's just well-reasoned from first principles. So in that view, Kyle, we're thinking, okay, if we, it makes sense for there to be one ledger, at least kind of, I don't want to say naively, but it makes a lot of it seems a lot easier if there's one ledger for all of these financial applications to interact with. But when I think about just what Jamie Dimon is going to want to do with JP Morgan chain and what Larry Fink is going to want to do with BlackRock chain, like I just think that these guys are smart enough to believe that owning their own asset ledger is extremely valuable and they don't want to be integrated. And it might be almost perverse, but I feel like it's almost human nature there too. And I'm just kind of curious if you had any thoughts or views around that.
There's definitely a real chance that Wall Street tries to create a bunch of permissioned asset ledgers, and then you try and use Chainlink or Layer Zero or Wormhole or whatever to make them talk to each other and or to public chains. I think there's a real probability that that is the end state configuration. If you talk to all the people, both at the banks and at the crypto teams, the Chainlinks, Layer Zeros, etc., they'll all tell you, like, very high probability that this would be the future state, which is these siloed permission chains, and then they talk to the public chain somehow. I assign a much lower probability than the people working on it do. Because I don't think that like they're getting a lot of benefits from having their permission chains other than like ego and control, which like is a real thing. But I think over time they'll just kind of realize like, hey, like there's all this money over here. Like I'll just go drop a contract down in the UI and I am better off doing that than I am having any notion of bridging at all. We aren't yet at the point where like that is the expectation of consumers. But I do think in 3 to 5 years, probably, that will be the expectation of consumers. And so the companies will conform to those expectations, is my general sense of the world.
I've got a question for you, Kyle. Maybe just getting to this, maybe just skip to right to the end here. Like, what do you think ultimately is going to be the market structure for like L1s here? Because there's, you know, everyone's got their favorite one for the most part, right? Like, you know, you're like a Bitcoin guy or an ETH guy or a Sol guy, or maybe a Sui or Aptos, right? But like, whatever. Probably at this point, we could all reasonably say there's not going to be just one, right? There's going to be multiple, you know, but we spent this whole episode talking about network effects. And I'd be curious to get your sense of like, I mean, how many L1s ultimately do we really need in this end state, especially if network effects around state are a very real thing? And yeah, and what does the sort of Pareto look like, right? It's like 80% of the state is on the leading blockchain, and then maybe there's like a really long tail, or like, what does that sort of end state look like from your perspective?
Well, the theoretical efficient answer is one, but the reason it's not going to be one is not for technical reasons, it will be for political reasons, which is just like, hey, there's like different, just like CISC versus RISC, or like SVM versus EVM, and like maybe MOVE, you know, I don't think MOVE has achieved escape velocity yet, but like there's a real non-zero chance that it does. And so, you know, we will, for just like, and the fact like people have different preferences of like developer environments and stuff. So you'll have some number of generalized L1s for that reason. I think the number is like somewhere between 3 and 7, probably closer to 3 than 7. And then, you know, how many L2s are there? That's harder to reason about. I think the L2s are generally nonsense. But like for the game use case, I get it. The question is just like, how many useful crypto games will there be? I think so far the answer is somewhere close to zero. I think the number will grow above zero at some point. But I don't know. Like, is it just we have the trading card games that like look like Hearthstone or Prime or whatever? I don't know if those really need to be on chain. Is it going to be stuff that looks more like Star Atlas and Parallel Colony? Those things, I buy them being, you know, on their own chain more. If like they have like a real thriving economy and like, but like how many of those games are there going to be? I don't know. Like that's like 0.1% of all games are of that mold and shape because they're very hard to build and like the scale required to build them is very high. And then like, are there other classes of games that really need this? You know, there's people playing around with Roblox style ideas, Minecraft style ideas. We'll see if those things need chains or not. Again, very much TBD. So there will be obviously a lot of side chains that people will build for these constrained environments. Those numbers will be very large, but I think that they will be economically irrelevant relative to the general chains that are supporting global finance.
Mm.
It's going to be like, hey, like there's NASDAQ and there's like you and your buddies playing poker. Like that'll be the scale of difference in terms of economic activity. And like, yeah, there will be a lot of small poker tables, but like obviously the volume that NASDAQ does is, you know, much larger.
So you would imagine a pretty steep Pareto then between like mostly the number one chain and then like really steep drop off after that, basically.
I think the top two or three chains could all be very large. I mean, like as far as I'm concerned, NASDAQ and CME are the same. So I don't actually know what their volumes are, but to me, they're like close enough to the same that they're the same. So 1, 2, and 3 could, I don't think it has to be 80, 15, 5. I don't think you need that kind of a power law distro. It could be 30, 30, 30. I don't think that's crazy because at that level of scale, all of them have enough scale to have all of the integrations and touch points and everything that like they work. Or like what's NYSE versus NASDAQ. I don't actually know, but I'm going to assume that they're effectively the same. But then there will be a very steep drop off to like all of the poker tables on the side. Those will be each game.
There is something interesting in here. Like I kind of, if we use the NYSE, NASDAQ, CME type analogy, like these are all, if those are the chains, there's like, you know, a handful of them and then a drop off to a bunch of smaller exchanges. But then the long tail stops because you know, you really can't just spin up like a tiny ass exchange. It doesn't make any sense. Because and so the difference in them.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's a regulatory barrier here. And so now with permissionless innovation and all that advantage in this market structure, we're talking about there being this long tail that's really, really long with all these like whatever people just deploy their own L2 because they can. And that's kind of interesting. And then you think about what happened there. And then in my bull case of crypto inventing new use cases, maybe there's some very cool new use cases that come out in those long tail asset ledgers that we never even thought about. That's like kind of fun. And that's pretty cool. I was just going to relate this back to like the interop concept too, because I don't think there is consensus yet between how these different chains do communicate or talk. Like I have a pretty, I think the view of sending messages between these chains is pretty idiotic in my opinion, and it's just not going to work very well. And there's the whole like a cross pitch about using intents and whatever, which I'm not here to shill. But I do think, Mike, we should spend more time thinking about, okay, if this is what the market structure looks like, how do these things actually get connected? And like, again, where does value accrual lie here too? Maybe just to pin that for future discussion.
Yeah, maybe we could close on that, Kyle, actually. What did Sam Hart say? It's like a luxury type question, like where does value accrue, right? Because everyone's just trying to build this stuff and make it work today. But I don't know. I feel like there are a couple of levels that maybe this could all like value could accrue. Like one is at the very base level, which is like the L1 type asset. Maybe you can even divide that. There's like a couple of different sort of lock-in areas. Like there's a VM sort of lock-in, like the EVM has been really valuable to ETH. I don't know. Could you like directly attribute that to ETH token price? I don't really know. Maybe it's more settlement. I'm not sure, but like maybe it accrues somewhere around there. There is another, there's another argument that you could make that maybe this is ultimately going to end up accruing to apps. And like one just bogey that we haven't really seen is like real successful apps with product market fit. Like there are very, arguably none really, but like there are very few that actually fit that definite, at least decentralized apps. Like the centralized exchanges are probably the biggest bucket. So like where, Kyle, like, I don't know, on a 10-year sort of time horizon, like at what layer of the stack do you see like value really accruing or like being the stickiest?
I think the L, those top two or three L1s, because they will be the substrate that captures MEV for global financial markets. And sorry, I shouldn't have said L1s. I should say whatever asset ledgers have the assets issued. That could be Arbitrum, it could be Optimism, it could be Solana, it could be who knows. But wherever, if you have the assets issued on L2 and then L1 is DA, your L1 is worthless. DA is not worth anything. Hmm. But Kyle, yeah.
Well, so I think your thesis here, which I generally agree with, but I think it's highly levered to how seamless interop is then. Where if like interop is more seamless, I think the Pareto curve, the shape of the power law distribution flattens, where they're going to have, you could have more asset ledgers because it's easier to move things between them. But if interop is kind of shitty or expensive or risky, then I think we get steeper and steeper in that power law distribution because like it is so hard to move between these asset ledgers. Does that make sense to you?
I agree. I mean, look, in the world in which interop is so smooth, you don't even know it's a thing. Then all of this is moot to entirely. But then also there's like different degrees of interop. Interop is not like, yeah, the base example is like trade asset A on chain A for asset A on chain B. But then there's like the borrow lend example, which is more complicated. And there's like derivatives and perpetuals, and there's like selling options. And like as the financial contracts themselves get more complicated, it will lend itself more towards one chain. Just because like enforcement of those contracts, it just becomes riskier and trickier. And like if scaling the dollars, you know, with like additional assumptions around finality and trust assumptions and bridges and all this other stuff, it just gets wonkier and wonkier. So there one is like spot trading, and the other is like getting higher levels of abstraction. There's a handful of teams trying to do, for example, like multi-chain borrow lend. I'm not actually, I forget their names.
Really hard. It's really hard.
It's just like a really, but like, and like borrow lend is like the foundation of financial markets. And so like that concerns me a lot. Right. And I haven't seen, you know, really good answers for that stuff. Generally agree. The better the interop is, the less steep the Pareto curve. That's definitely true. I have yet to see compelling solutions on the interop side such that it makes me believe that the curve will be meaningfully less steep.
Guys, I think we have to wrap up here, but Kyle, this was an awesome episode. Yeah, man, thank you so much for coming on. And you know, if folks want to find out more about how do they follow you or find out more about Multicoin or whatever, what's the best way to do that?
Appreciate the kind words, Hart and Mike. Awesome to be on the show. And yeah, in terms of where to follow us, I am Kyle Samani on Twitter. It's my name. Multicoin does have a Twitter account. We do not tweet from it. There's been several times people thought we were dead because the Twitter account didn't have any tweets. But no, it turns out that we just don't tweet from it. You can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Samani. And then our website is multicoin.capital. And if you want to subscribe to the blog, there's a little email subscribe thing at the top.
Sweet. Cool.
Yeah, Kyle, it's awesome. Thank you so much, man.
Mike Hart, appreciate the time, guys. Great to be on the show.
All right, man. That was a great interview. Often very contrarian, always interesting. Always interesting. What do you think?
I want to do more podcasts with Kyle Samani. That was fun. I really appreciated like the honesty of his takes. And you know, yeah. I think people out there think Kyle's just like a soul bull and whatever. And it's good. He should be. He should be proud of it. But I also think he's like pretty open to, I thought he was pretty open to feedback and pretty open to different arguments for why his theses might not play out, which was really actually refreshing.
Me too. I also got to give, I think one of the things that Kyle's done well over the years is he's been extremely consistent in his views, and to his credit, honestly, like I think a lot of his early theses, which were pretty, I don't know, unpopular is not the right word, but not mainstream accepted, have proven out to be pretty correct. So I don't know if you have, I had a couple takeaways, but I don't know if anything jumped out at you to start.
I think the takeaway is politics here. Like, at a very high level. So it's like, okay, I don't want to use the word naively, because I think that like almost discredits like Kyle's take here. But I think it seems simpler if everything is on one ledger, if everything is integrated. And let's even say that that's not a technology problem, that we actually can build a single ledger that scales to do whatever we need to do, which might not actually be possible. But like, put that aside, why would everybody want to be on the same ledger? Well, the real answer is why they wouldn't want to be. And the answer is control, ego, capturing value, just other aspects of this that I think are real and like can't be ignored. And so then I think Kyle like accurately embraces this. There will be some distribution of asset ledgers. And that distribution of asset ledgers will be flatter. There'll be more of them that are more equally sized if we have seamless interop, and it'll be much steeper if we don't. And to me, that seems like a really logical take. That was my big takeaway.
I think so as well. And I think that agrees with something that I think it's the closing thought that we ended last episode with, which is, you know, when you're talking about L2s, like the big problem isn't a technical one, it is a social one. And I think that equally applies for L1 to L1. Like there's going to be this constant perennial incentive for, you know, I mean, control or ego is kind of it maybe sounds a little bit derogatory, but like opportunity, right? Like if you are some bright enterprising developer and think you can be a founder and see problems with the existing ecosystems and you think you could build a better one, like that's kind of that's beautiful. Like go and see if you can build it, create value. And I just think that is, I've never really bought into the one chain to rule them all viewpoint because of exactly that. And I would even go so far as to say it's a moral imperative to create new chains, new sources of competition that will force existing incumbents to not act like incumbents and challenge them to keep innovating and be better. And yeah, that's, I think it's a really positive thing. So
I also agree that it's generally a really positive thing. I think something else I was debating about whether we could talk to Kyle about it. I do think in a world where launching your own L2 becomes an easy way to have your own token, I think that there is another set of incentives there that are purely financial. And again, not all bad, right? But I could see a world, I don't think it's a low probability world that 6 to 12 months from now, we have everybody launching their own L2 because it's a clear path to monetization for them, at least in kind of like a excuse to have a token type way.
Well, I know we, one of the crux of debate there, which we kind of went down a rabbit hole, but I thought it was pretty interesting, is like, are these things more equity-like instruments or commodity-like instruments? And I think the answer is that they're probably a mix of both. There's a really great podcast, I can't remember, it was on Invest Like the Best years ago, but it was this guy who was investing in Google in the early days, and he talked about how analysts tied themselves up in knots as, you know, is it a media company or a telecom company? Ultimately, it was something totally new, it was a different category, and if you spent time trying to apply a comp for media or telecom, both of them were going to be wildly off. So you should have just looked at the thing for what it is instead of like what buckets you can put it in. But one of the commodity-like aspects to me of this industry is that at some point, the cost of spinning up alternatives becomes very low. And this is ultimately like why a huge contributor to why I think crypto operates in cycles. Because, and by the way, I love Bitcoin, but one thing that I think the Bitcoiners just always underestimate is this 21 million hard cap supply. What happens when in commodity land, when you have an extremely constrained supply and price goes up, is one of two things. Either the price goes down or people find alternatives because your solution is too expensive. It's a commodity. Usually there's a substitute. And the cost of in crypto spinning up new substitutes, be that new L1s in the past, now it's new L2s or whatever, is extremely low. And so that's why, you know, I don't know how I feel about it. I think the L2 landscape today is probably a little bit overcrowded. I don't know what you think about that, but that's why there are many commodity-like dynamics I see here.
Okay, so I like the push that it's like, is it a commodity, is it an equity, or going back to like, is Google a media company or a telecom company? They're like, no, it's something new. One thought here would be like, okay, I am a software developer. I'm going to use this term very loosely. So I'm making some application that's primarily software that people want to use. And 20 years ago, the way I sold my software was I shrink wrapped it and put it on like Best Buy store shelves, and people bought software that way, right? And then there was like the App Store, and now I like had in-app purchases, and that's how I monetize my software. And then for games, there's like free-to-play type shit too, right? And I kind of wonder if like running your own blockchain might be another way you monetize your software. And I don't think it'll pan out exactly like that, but I think it very well could be a way that people monetize their own software. Because it just becomes an easy way to do so. And you have a token that trades and da 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 da, you know, something like that. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. It does suppose, though, that you have like seamless interop or relatively seamless interop. And again, I think depending on your use case, your interop challenges are going to be very different. And I think, you know, Kyle agreed with that. Games on their own L2 made a lot of sense to him. And again, we need useful game use cases here. But if the technology is getting better and better and L2s are getting cheap and fast and all these other things, maybe it becomes like the next free-to-play type business model for game developers. I'm not totally sure.
Yeah, I think maybe one way to knit these two different perspectives together would be this guy, Preston Evans from Sovereign Labs, gave this great analogy of like trust zones. And maybe the reality, just the political challenge here, is getting different ecosystems to adopt the same set of standards, but maybe intra-ecosystem, like that's ultimately what defines the border of these different ecosystems, like standards that get adopted within this, like maybe one set of trust zone is like Ethereum plus rollups or something like that. And yeah, you get a game that has its own block space, like its own dedicated L2, but maybe it just sort of agrees that like, yep, maybe because of the background of the developers or the founders, they're either come from Ethereum or they're comfortable working in whatever. I guess there might be a custom VM for a game, but whatever. Like these set of standards feel right to me, and I'm going to build my own. I'm going to own these economics and block space, but I'm going to agree to work within the set of standards in the Ethereum world. And maybe there'll be the equivalent in Solana Land or Celestia or wherever. So maybe that's ultimately how it goes. But what I hear from you a lot, Hart, that I think is basically like the interop, people are still underestimating the difficulty of it. And maybe a lot of these apps won't require as much as we're assuming that they will. Is that a fair sort of assumption
or yeah,
like summary?
That's totally fair. And I think it makes it, I'm yet to see strong arguments against this with few use cases. So Kyle brought up, you know, cross-chain borrow lend. That is a very hard interop problem. And I think that's something that I think is extremely difficult. But if you're going to run your own application, what are your interop or composability needs? For the most part, like if it's Poker Chain or your own perpetual DEX or margin trading platform, your only interop need is to have people get assets onto your chain. And then you've got to at least offer them the ability to get them off your chain. And that's much more solvable. And I think it's solvable, you know, again, shill what I'm working on with Across, but there's like stuff there that works really, really well, really fast and cheap today. I thought Kyle's point around, so I agree, Mike. Like, I think that people have this idea that I need to seamlessly talk between all these blockchains at the same time. And I just don't actually see the use cases for that. I think that there's very, very few of them.
Okay. And that, you know, I think that ultimately is the driving factor, right? It's like, is there real demand? If there's demand, we'll always find a way. If there's not demand, maybe that explains why it's been a thorny or more persistent problem than everyone predicted. So I think the data agrees with you, Hart. All right. We've got to wrap it here. We've got an absolute banger of a last episode that we're planning. So make sure to tune in, guys. And then Hart and I are going to wrap
up, Mike.
Huh?
We'll keep it secret, but is it
we're
Lando?
Very close. Yeah. It's we're on the final lap here of scheduling, but yeah, it's going to be great. And then we're going to do a recap of the season. I honestly, I've loved every season. I really do feel like I have updated the mission of this season of like updating my mental model has been successful, at least for me. Like I've learned a ton and I am thinking about things more differently about almost any other season than I was in the beginning. So yeah, feeling good.
Me too, man. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds great. And yeah, looking forward to that next episode.
Cheers, partner. Hey, everyone. Want to give a final shout out to this episode's title sponsor, Say. Now, there are a whole bunch of really exciting reasons to be building on Say V2 outside of just parallelization. I want you to head over to say.io to looking into building on their public DevNet. Again, click the link at the bottom of this episode and head over to say.io to start building something today.